Welcome to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. This is our 55th episode, and we've picked up people, you know, from all kinds of different parts of the country, and it's great to hear that our friends, some of them behind the tofu curtain in California, or up in the occupied northeast of the United States, that even they enjoy the podcast also. So that's a very, very nice thing. And we welcome everyone. And again, this is all opinions, so you are very free to disagree. And if you have any questions or anything you would like to have me address, just go ahead. You can leave it in the comments on Podbean, you know, which is where all of us amateur podcast people kind of hang out. I think there are some other probably comparable services. The one thing I have to tell you is I am not an expert at this, obviously. So, you know, one of the things that was always kind of neat is how do I do a podcast? And the, you know, to digress into this tangent a little bit, I heard one other podcaster say that he used Audacity, and it was a free program, so I downloaded that. I realized pretty quick, and you'll know from the first few episodes, that just the standard mic on my laptop wasn't a quality piece of gear. So I went out and I spent $10 at Walmart, where I don't shop anymore because they don't like to sell certain types of ammunition. But I went and bought a cheap desktop microphone, which, you know, was going to be really is much better quality and a much better piece of equipment. And it would have been really effective had I remembered to turn it on like the first 10 podcasts after I bought it. I hooked it up and I didn't realize you had to select a little deal on the software to make it work. So, you know, that's why there was not a real continuous evolutionary improvement, a quantum leap improvement after I bought the thing. I'm like, wow, this doesn't really work any better than the mic I have in my laptop. Then after a while, I realized I had not turned it on. So I am not a great expert when it comes to podcasting. I can barely get the music in. And so it's, you know, pretty interesting. And it's been a lot of fun to do, actually. And it's, you know, it just kind of gives you a lot of fun. I always thought I would enjoy some sort of radio, because I listen to radio quite a bit. I listen to it in my car. I listen to podcasts, you know, download them onto my phone and listen to them while I'm driving. And I always thought, man, that's something I'd really like to do. Well, now I've done it, and it is fun. But, you know, hey, I am accessible. So feel free to contact me through the services, or you can email me at kbmakel@aol.com. kbmakel@aol.com, and go ahead and put in podcast in the title somewhere, so I kind of know where it's from. So I know it's not one of the hundreds of spams I get every day. First thing, we can talk about impeachment, and I have to say, I told you so. There's basically a resolution on the Senate floor somewhere that was introduced by about a dozen senators saying, hey, we don't see these things in 25 days. We're just going to dismiss the trial, and everything is going to be a lot better. So that's all I'm going to say about that. You know what I think about it. I've probably talked about it too much, but it does seem to be one of those gnawing things. If you're actually a patriot and believe in the United States, this impeachment has been something that has really been terrible. And, you know, so we can go to a couple of other things. First of all, by virtue of who and where I work, I was able to see some of the, and they're not out on the internet anywhere, so don't look for them, but see some of the pictures of the Suleiman strike. And, you know, that's kind of been in the news, these pictures have been, and they are pretty gruesome. And all I can tell you is, you know, it's a sobering thing to look at that, because we are not kidding around with these people. You know, for years and years, a lot of these groups, or some of these, you know, countries like Iran, kind of push us around. They go in, they kill a few people, you know, and we just kind of shrug it off and just, you know, again, Obama's strongly worded statement. No, you know, the fact of the matter is, we as a nation should be done with strongly worded statements when a terrorist strikes at our citizens. We should be done with that. We should reply exactly as we've done in this Suleiman thing. Their lives are in jeopardy when they do that. When they attack us, their lives become in jeopardy. And I know the Hellfire kind of started out as an anti-tank weapon, and I'm sure they've modified the warheads so it can do a variety of things and probably several different versions. But let me tell you something, that Hellfire missile did a job, and it blew this guy to pieces. And, you know, and that was as gruesome as you can imagine. The couple of the things that were interesting to gun people is he had a pistol in a holster. I couldn't identify what kind it was. But that was pretty much, that was singed pretty hard, too. And so it leads you to believe that a fireball just went through there. And one of the AKs was completely burned and came apart. You know, they just had kind of parts of an AK. So, you know, it's really interesting how, you know, we have weapons, they work. And we don't have to sit there and just idly stand by while these terrorists provoke and push us. So, definitely a sobering, but also a very satisfying thing to see that finally we're striking back. You know, when these guys strike, we strike back. And I'm not worried about their, quote, retaliation. They need to be looking over their shoulders because we can strike again and again and again. We have the hardware. They don't. And I think actually they kind of see that, which is why they bluster so much. Okay. A couple of things going on. Recoil Magazine. I pick up a copy of this thing about once a year. I guess it's appealing to a much younger audience. It's not really, and there's nothing wrong with that. I actually like that. It's very AR-centric. It's very, you know, kind of Glock pistol, you know, those whole thing of the striker-fired trigger safety pistol, very centric to those two. But the interesting part is, and it's not 1911 centric at all, you know. So I think they're trying to create a new mold for the gun magazine because they realize the old ones just, you know, they're pretty much haven't changed much in 50 or 60 years. So that's a good thing on their part. The article I took umbrage with, and frankly I couldn't even stomach it to finish it, was about old shooters and how you accommodate these frail old shooters. And, you know, my whole deal is that unless you're just, you can't see anymore, or you've somehow lost your mental faculties, a lot of old shooters shoot better than younger shooters. I see it on the range all the time. I mean, you'll see people who are much older who basically are quite good shots. And you think about it, well, maybe the guy's got 30 or 40 years of practice, has refined his equipment, and basically, you know, has the physical attributes to still utilize it, you know. And I've seen a lot of, you know, I hate to do a broad brush, but I've seen a lot of younger shooters that don't shoot very well. They kind of get out. You see them at public ranges all the time. They're kind of laughing. And, you know, to them it's just kind of this lark where they go out. Whereas when you see a guy show up and he's got one of those old school pistol cases, you know, that you put it on top of the bench and open it. And it's got a place for the spotting scope and two or three target pistols inside. I've got one in my basement. I've got one of these things in my basement that I don't use, but they're still very cool. But if you see that, and you see a guy out there, a lot of times those guys are shooting, and they are deadly accurate. And you also see them in places where you wouldn't think. You know, you'll see older shooters in three-gun USPSA in a lot of places. So I kind of thought this was a guy who ginned up an article, and basically what I think about it is, if you've lost so much of your physicality that you can only shoot a 22 with some kind of optical sight on it, or wherever that article is going, maybe you shouldn't be armed. Maybe you should be living in a very secure place, you know, one of those patrolled neighborhoods and all the rest of it. You know, it just didn't make sense to me that they were trying to pander, create this thing of, well, there's this declining, these shooters in their declining years need to be treated like they're handicapped. And that's just ridiculous. You see it in the American Rifleman all the time, the armed citizen, where, yeah, somebody breaks in on an 80-year-old woman or an 85-year-old Korean War veteran. And, you know, a lot of times that doesn't end so well for the bad guys. It ends in a slab in the morgue. So not every time, but it has happened. And or they run out there fleeing with the bullets in their hide and get captured at a hospital, you know, a few hours later. So I would say that, you know, to kind of think that there's this population of declining and creaky old shooters out there is really the reality is somewhat different. So that's my take on Recoil Magazine. I just, some of the other stuff's okay. I noticed they also put out a survivalist version, which is, you know, the usual claptrap nonsense that gets out of that, you know, prepping. And, you know, they always put, what I always love is the guys they put on the front of these things look like, you know, high-speed Blackwater-type contractors, you know. And the bug-out vehicle, I guess, which is what they're illustrating, is always like some Hummer with all sorts of upgrades, you know, the fancy, you know, racks. It really kind of looks like a quasi-military vehicle. And, of course, these guys are carrying, you know, M4s with whatever the latest goodies are on it. And it kind of goes like that. And you look at that and you go, you know, of the preppers I've seen, that's just not the model that I'm used to. So maybe it's how they see themselves and not how they're seen. It's usually old pickup truck and all the rest. And the guy doesn't look like a Blackwater contractor. He looks like just a regular guy, you know, or, you know, and it's just, they don't have all the high speed, you know, pouches and gear and all this stuff. It's really kind of funny. The image they're selling of the prepper or the survivalist, which I guess is an old term now, but the image they're selling doesn't match up with the reality very well. So we got a kind of a question that doesn't really fit into the question and answer part. So I'm gonna go ahead and start talking about it right here. First of all, this is not any kind of legal advice. I'm not a lawyer. Whatever other kind of statement to distance myself from telling you what the right, wrong, state laws are all different, you know, consult a lawyer on any legal matters. I'm just telling you my from the gut thing and some experience, because this kind of happened to me. So anyway, here is kind of the question, and this was asked of me by someone who was working in a situation where they did not feel, where they felt kind of threatened. So, what to do if someone threatens you at work? And work can also, I suppose, mean school. I suppose it can mean any place where you interact with other people. It's what happens when someone threatens you. And I think everybody has been threatened at one point or another, at least in childhood, whether it's on the playground and some kid wants to kick your butt because of this, that, or the other thing, or whatever that is. But there's a darker, more insidious type of threat, which happens in the workplace. I mean, it happens in the workplace, it primarily. Could happen at, you know, school, college, or beyond, or whatever kind of situation that you're in. And that's a very uncomfortable position to be in. And, you know, we've seen I'm not talking about the terrorist stuff that gets labeled as workplace violence, but there is legitimate workplace violence. And what are you supposed to do if you see what you think might be the nascent signs of a problem? You know, how do you handle that? What do you do? And the advice I'll give you is basically, I had a similar type situation. I did not take it that seriously, and that could have turned out to be a mistake. It turned out it was fine, and I never thought this person would actually do anything. But here's kind of the breakdown of this. If you are, especially if you're in a supervisory or management type position, you're going to have to do some things that are uncomfortable with people. And that is, tell low performers that they're low performers, and you're going to put them on a program, usually or a counseling, to attempt to correct their behavior and improve their performance. That's just one of the things that happens. We usually just don't say, "Hey, yep, you're fired, you're gone." Larger companies, especially, they have ways they all have to do this, and it's all vetted through the legal department. It's part of a larger process of how they treat employees that are not performing to the correct standard. But to leave all that gobbledygook behind, you could be in a position where someone threatens you at work and you don't feel particularly safe because most of us are not allowed to carry at work. Most of us don't want to carry at work. I don't want to carry at work. I'll tell you that right now. I know everybody, a lot of the concealed carry guys are like, "Oh, you should get a license and carry everywhere." Well, you know what? I really don't want to carry at work. I really don't. I mean, I don't want to have a firearm on me while I'm at my desk and all that. I really don't. So, how do you feel safe? How do you handle this kind of situation? And I would say the first thing to do is kind of the common sense stuff. And that is, you need to tell your boss, and I would write down the particulars of the statement. I would also contact the human resources. Usually they have some kind of a open line that you can call and report this kind of stuff. But make sure somebody knows that you've been threatened. Make sure somebody knows. That way, later on down the road, if something happens, they'll say, "Well, everybody will wash their hands and say, we didn't know anything. Nobody told us." This time you got to tell them. You got to tell them as precisely as you can, and that's why you want to write down the particulars and submit that to either HR, your boss, whatever the deal is. You got to make sure that that's all known. Now, I was quite surprised. It's an employee threatening someone in the workplace. I would think that that would be immediate grounds for immediate termination and all that. And sometimes it can be, but a lot of times it's not. And I'll tell you how this evil manifested itself. There's a military hospital, a small one, near where I work. One of the army nurses, now this is an army first lieutenant or captain, I think it was first lieutenant, nurse, a young lady in her mid to late 20s, was required to supervise a whole bunch of programs, which included some that where the workers were government service called GS employees. To make a long story short, she had one guy who was a problem, went through the whole thing, discharged him, and unbeknownst to her, because she was kind of, she thought that was the end of the deal. Well, unfortunately, they have a union which represents them and got this guy's job back. So, not too long later, this guy, the bad seed, pops up on the scene. And he's got his old job back because the union has advocated for him, and now he's back where he was, and it's start over from square one. Now, she had tried to get this guy to improve his performance, and he was very hostile towards her. She told her bosses, "Hey, I don't trust this guy. I don't want to be in the vicinity with him alone. This is a bad deal." They all blew it off. Just like, remember Fort Hood, the shooter, the Fort Hood shooting. Remember how everybody kind of knew this guy was a wacko, but they all blew it off, and nobody did anything. Well, this is the same kind of deal. One day she called this guy in her office and started to confront him with his misdeeds or whatever, and the guy came back a short time later, and he actually had gasoline, matches, and other stuff And he doused her, you know, walks right up to her, douses her with gasoline, lit her on fire. And she got some very, very nasty burns. Very nasty burns. So she's screaming, burning, and a couple other people come in, try to assist her, and then in which case he attacks them with scissors, okay? This is where this kind of stuff can lead. When you're discharging someone, you know, they kind of see that as their world is ending, you know, the paycheck's ending, the whole thing. They're not concerned enough, I guess, to improve their performance, but they are concerned enough to lash out. So this woman was severely burned, and I mean, had to go through all kinds, and you can imagine how painful that was. Her face, fortunately, was not burned. However, her upper torso and arm and things were burned. You know, and I'll just leave that as it may. You can understand the pain that must cause, and especially the psychological pain of someone who's going to be scarred like that and all that. Well, as it turns out, this guy, he actually pled guilty and got like 25 years. And since he was in his 50s, I guess they figure that that's going to basically take care of him for the rest of his life. But he never has to experience the pain or anything else that he inflicted. I mean, he's just going to go to jail, and that's that. And he doesn't have to live with those kind of scars the rest of his life, you know, and it'd probably be a very long life, you know. I mean, people live to their late 70s and 80s, and so she could have those scars for 60-some years, you know, who knows. So, you know, this kind of stuff has to be taken seriously. When someone threatens you, you've got to let everybody know. And I would also say the next thing you have to do is, and everybody wants me to leave, get a pistol and carry it everywhere. When they confront you, you blast them like Dirty Harry. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you've got to make yourself a more difficult target. And it's going to require some changes, and some changes that you probably don't want to make. One of them is be careful where you go. Don't increase your vulnerability. And that is, hey, you know, don't get drunk in public where somebody can come up and just throttle you. You know, I mean, if you have to travel with, and this person is part of the person who's kind of giving you trouble is part of your travel group or whatever. Don't get publicly drunk. Don't put yourself in a position of vulnerability. Avoid them unless it's business and you have to talk to them. Avoid them. You want to avoid interacting with them so that they don't go off and do something. Next thing you want to do is, you know, increase your non-lethals. And you can do that with, they make some very, very clever bear spray or pepper spray. You know, things that are not the little miniature fire extinguisher looking things that we're used to. But they have some that actually look, you know, for women, they look like, you know, a perfume or a kind of a makeup thing, you know, kind of would fit in, something that wouldn't immediately scream that it's pepper spray. And I guess men could probably do the same thing, find something that looks a little more innocuous. Another thing I would do is within the regulations of your workplace, if you can carry a small folding knife, I'd probably carry that. You know, and I have done that. I mean, I have a small folding knife. Hey, and it's good for, you know, just, you know, especially if some people see you opening letters or packages with it, they really don't think twice about it. But, hey, you've got it and it's on you. You know, it just goes to say that you have to watch yourself and watch your surroundings. Be a lot more situationally aware. Now, I will say that if it escalates and you see this person like around your home or around, you know, or like following you or anything like that, then you need to get the police involved and, you know, kind of, and if you've already done the previous things of, hey, I notified everybody at work, this guy's threatened me, and now I'm kind of seeing him around my neighborhood, you know, it doesn't hurt. Let everyone know. Finally, the final thing I would say is that within the rights of your state and your legal position and everything else, there are times when it will be prudent to be armed and have a defensive either handgun or rifle in your home, or shotgun in your home, And if you live in, if you have a CCW, you can certainly use that. Or if you live in a constitutional carry state, you can go armed, and that will do it. The other thing too is make sure that you know, if you've got family members, make sure they're kind of appraised of what's going on. And you know, you might have to modify a few things. Maybe there's some things you don't go to. Maybe, you know, whatever it takes to increase your security until this situation is resolved. You know, that's kind of what you have to do. Other things you can do is like vary your routes and times to and from work. And, you know, you can usually coordinate that with your boss pretty well, saying, hey, you know, a couple times this week I'm going to be coming in about 15, 20 minutes late, or I'm going to be coming in a little bit early and leaving a little bit early. Whatever you can do to kind of mix up your routine so you're not as predictable. But it's a very uncomfortable and a very bad situation. So my recommendations are, you know, and again, I'm no lawyer and I'm no expert in this field, but I would say let people know. Let people know you've been threatened or you're under some sort of, there's been some sort of incident or there's some reason that you're not feeling 100% safe. Do what you can to increase your defensive posture within the law and within the keeping of your company's regulations. If a company is like most companies, they say, hey, no weapons on company property. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, abide by that. But also do those other things to kind of make yourself a little harder target. You might even want to move your work location. Say, hey, I need to be kind of over here because that way I can see things. Whatever it is you need to do to make yourself feel more safe. And usually the 99.999% of these things end without there being any kind of a problem, without anything really happening. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And I told you the story about the nurse who was, you know, literally attacked with gasoline and set on fire. These kind of things have happened. And so, you know, do what you can to protect yourself and protect the people around you. You know, especially if you have a family at home, let them know that, hey, there's been some threats and anything out of the ordinary, let's act on the cautious side and getting the appropriate either company people or law enforcement involved. And lastly, you know, make sure that you do have some defensive arms just in case. But it's a very uncomfortable situation, and it's something that no one should really have to face, but occasionally we do because, you know, as people interact, some people interact poorly. So anyway, that's the one thing I really wanted to address before we got into the Q&A, which is the best part of this podcast. Okay. So here is the Q&A part of the podcast. And the first question is, why do you criticize gun content producers so much? Do you have something against them? The answer is no, I have nothing against them. I suppose in many ways I could be considered a content creator myself, although I don't really think I do that. But anyway, why do I go after, and I don't really go after them, but why do I comment on writers and video, you know, YouTubers and all that? It's because I think there has to be a level of honesty. And part of that honesty is these guys go out and they do a lot of shilling. Not every single one of them, and they don't do it all the time, the ones that do. But they do a lot of shilling for companies or for other things that they think are a great idea, and they know that they can influence. So they're influencers. They're trying to influence people to do something. Now, there are a couple of really egregious examples of this. I mean, just if you're old enough to remember the Bren 10, you know, Jeff Cooper was basically bought, and he basically endorsed this Bren 10 as the ultimate defensive firearm. I remember reading about it and going, for years, if you're not familiar with Jeff Cooper, for years he said the ultimate defensive firearm is the M1911. And for all the reasons that people love M1911s. So I sit there and I go, okay, that's great. So then all of a sudden it comes out, well, there's this thing called a Bren 10, which is a CZ-75 that's been basically enlarged. The CZ-75 is a great pistol, but it's in 9mm, or in those days they would call it 9 cm. So it's in 9 cm, so that's obviously no good. But this, these guys in Florida, I think they were in Florida, they've gone ahead and they've enlarged it and they created a whole new 40 caliber 10 millimeter cartridge for it. And this is the ultimate gun. Well, as it turned out, it was not the ultimate gun. It was big, heavy, had too much recoil, very difficult to conceal. And then they had, like a lot of nascent gun manufacturers, they basically were undercapitalized, and somehow the agreement with the company to make magazines fell through. And so if you bought the gun, you got one magazine and couldn't get any more. Some guns were shipped even without magazines. I imagine that was awesome. And so on and on. And so this thing was an epic fail. But if you were somebody who was new and knew that Jeff Cooper was a big influencer, knew that he was a guy who was looked upon as a big expert, you would have gone for it hook, line, and sinker, and I'm sure a lot of people did. And the only reason that happened was he just had to have been purchased. They said, endorse our gun and we will pay you X amount of dollars. And even though he knew he would be saying, well, you know, I'm going against what I really preach, which is that the 1911 is the ultimate defensive handgun. So anyway, that was a disaster. Another one that kind of he was behind was that whole inception of the scout rifle. This can do everything. This is this kind of, I guess, kind of a fusion of sporting rifle and tactical rifle. You know, they always kind of dangled it out there that it had all these kind of tactical applications. As it turned out, it's a very generalist sporting rifle that's decent at a lot of things, but not really good at any one thing, and that's just not what people buy. I mean, when you want to buy a super accurate gun, you don't buy a scout rifle. When you want to buy something that's really fast handling and very, very quick, you might not buy a scout rifle. You might buy something else. So people tend to buy the instrument for the task that they need. And if they own two or three instruments for different tasks, well, so be it. So those are a couple of examples. Another example is, remember I guess it's like 4 years ago now, 3 or 4 years ago, InRange TV was pushing this Hill & Mack Gunworks, HMG, because they were going to make a Sturmgewehr in a variety of calibers. And as far as I know, $1,700, you send them the money, and they were going to send you a Sturmgewehr semi-automatic. And I don't think a single one has been delivered, other than perhaps they might have some tool room kind of pre-production guns and how well they work. And you could get them in 300 blackout, 5.56, the original 8x33 or 7.62x39, you know, on and on. You could get Sturmgewehrs. Okay, never happened, never was there. Another thing they pushed was the Hudson H9, the what was it, $1,100 9mm pistol that, you know, when you can go out and buy Glocks and other things, Smith & Wesson M&Ps and all this other stuff, you can buy all this kind of stuff for, you know, half the price. And sometimes less than half the price for a functioning 9mm. And, of course, then these Hudson H9s had all kinds of problems and on and on and on, you know. And so, you know, it is what it is. But these guys push all this stuff, and nobody steps up and says, hey, wait a minute, who's calling BS on this? I will tell you that I think, and I haven't done the, I haven't invested the $300 to find out, but I'm very skeptical that the new Brownells Retroscope is any better than the Barsco ones you can buy for about $60. I'm skeptical, and I told you my story with the other thing that the charging handle that I got. You know, I waited for like 4 months for the Brownells No DAC Spud $50 charging handle, and in the interim, I bought one from Luth AR or Fulton Armory, somebody else. And I'll be darned, when the Brownells one showed up, it was exactly the same. Exactly, except for the NDS marking. So, you know, a lot of stuff gets hyped, and that they're the only ones that have it, and they're doing it. The latest piece of hype was, what was this on? It was on something where Larry Vickers, you know, the guy, Delta Force and all that. I mean, you know, entertaining videos and has done some, I guess, some decent work. But, you know, he put out the new, he heard from Ken Hackathorn. Hackathorn is an old crony of Jeff Cooper's, and he must, there's really very little bio information on Ken Hackathorn other than he's, I'm sure he's got to be in probably getting close to 80. I mean, he's up there. And it's about the new Colt Python and how the new Colt Python was going to be better than the old Colt Pythons because it's really made for shooting. And the old Colt Pythons had weak actions and everybody knew it. And first of all, I say he's flat ass wrong. That Colt, the problem with Colt double action revolvers, and the Python was one of them, is they're very, very difficult to tune sometimes for gunsmiths. It's a challenging action. It's more difficult than Smith & Wesson to tune. Not that anybody tunes revolvers anymore, because they don't. that's gone the, you know, that's, go ahead and get your hula hoop and your 8-track set, your 8-track tape, because that's where revolver tuning has gone. It's back there. Yeah, go get your timing light for your carburetor, because all that stuff is gone. And revolver tuning is one of those things that's just not really around anymore. So anyway, so I kind of thought about it, and I go, well, wait a minute. First of all, he's commenting on a gun he hasn't seen. Always dangerous. Whenever you say anything other than, hey, they're coming out with this, it exists, and the pictures sure look good. Anytime you put anything else up there, you are taking a risk. Then to say, well, we know it's going to be better than the old ones. And it's like, well, how is it better? Because what that means is that they've made changes. And if you make changes, is it still a Python, or is it a Python-like object? You know, last podcast I said the biggest thing you got to worry about is that these things are going to be a Python on the outside and a Taurus tracker on the inside. You know, that's what you got to worry about. So I don't know how you can say that. I just don't believe that CNC, NIM, made parts are going to make these guns somehow better than the originals, which were all forged steel and fitted by hand on some level. I mean, it's just, that's just the way it goes. I mean, the Pythons were kind of semi-custom built. They put a, I guess the best way to characterize it is they put a lot of finishing and individual fitting into those guns. So, you know, you have those guns, you have those guns. But there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that the new one is going to be any better. And why would you make a statement like that? Unless you're somehow shilling for these things and you want people to go out and buy them. Somehow, he has now just endorsed the Colt Python without ever having seen one, taking someone else's word for it. And that's one of the reasons I kind of go after these guys. I kind of go after them and call them out and say, well, how do you know? I have no idea. The new Colt Python could be the greatest revolver ever made, as far as I know. I've only seen pictures, and I'm not even sure if the pictures I've seen are of the Pythons they're making. You know, I mean, there's a picture of a Python. Well, I recognize it as a Python. Could be an old a photograph from when they were making Pythons back in the 90s, and they stopped in 2002 or 2003, whenever it was. So I just, unless you can tell me or show me some reason why it's changed and it's more durable, and then know this, not just have been told this, but know this, I think it's out there shilling, and you see a lot of shilling going on for some of this stuff. It's a lot of times you could always read, you had to read between the lines of the old gun magazines when they were doing a review saying, well, this doesn't turn out target accuracy, but it's accuracy good for a duty gun. Well, that tells you it's not an very accurate gun. That's what they're telling you. And if you didn't read between the lines, you had no idea what was going on. They're telling you it's good enough, but it's obviously not very good. So that's the reason that I critique gun content creators, is because I believe there needs to be a level of honesty. I believe there needs to be a level of common sense. Somebody saying, hold it, hold it. What you're saying is not exactly true, or at least it bears further explanation, because these guys will tell you anything, because that's the way capitalism works. Somehow they've been induced to endorse a product so that you buy it and everybody makes money and you get a product in your hand, and sometimes that product can be a turd if it even shows up, like in the case of the mythical Sturmgewehr. If there are unicorns, I'm sure that wherever the unicorns are grazing, there's this big stack of Sturmgewehrs, because several companies have tried to make them, but none have ever been seen out in public yet. Except for the ATI 22 caliber one, which I'm a proud owner of one, and I have to say that's a fun gun. I wish where I shoot would allow the 22 tracers, because that would probably be a lot of fun. They're 22 long rifle, and firing the tracers out of that would probably be a real kick in the pants. But for me, until I find another place to shoot, that's not in the cards. So, but other than that, it's very good. It does, though, when you pull the trigger, it is not the satisfying intermediate cartridge reaction that you would expect. It is more of a very, very muted 22 caliber pop. So there you go. Okay, why are revolvers popular in the U.S. and not the rest of the world? Well, there's several reasons for that. The first reason is revolvers kind of, World War I was the high watermark for revolvers. I mean, that was it. After World War I, everybody, not everybody, but semi-automatics really dominated the market. That was the new cool thing. And even in the United States, or the Colt, they had the 1911 sold. They were still selling the 1905. The 1903 pocket hammerless was an extremely successful design. All kinds of automatic pistols were on the market, but revolvers, Americans love revolvers, and part of the reason was power, and part of the reason was the lack of complexity for all a broad spectrum of police. The police didn't always have the professional training and standards that we're used to today. And so a revolver was still, especially a double action revolver, was considered a very, very good, very solid, very durable, very reliable, and reasonably simple to shoot mechanism, whereas people who'd never had a train had any training on a semi-automatic firearm, if you hand them even the simplest kind, simple blowback 32 or 380, it was going to be a problem. Another thing was people were used to revolver cartridges. 38 Special just seemed to take on a life of its own, so you could get it everywhere. I don't know that you could get 380 anywhere back in the 30s. And 32, probably a little more available, but it was a pretty sure bet before there were places. There weren't Cabela's back then. No Bass Pro Shops, no Cabela's, no Academy Sports. You went to the general store and whatever old Joe had on the on the shelf, that was pretty much it. So a lot of those were, you know, traditional cartridges. The other thing was, you know, a lot of those cartridges had a very, very excellent reputation. 45 Cold, 40, all the 4440, 44 Special. They all had a very, very good reputation. So there were guns still being made for them. They were still considered to be powerful, reliable, fashionable, and all that good stuff. So, you know, that was the deal, and it just continued. We had, you know, some of the most influential, go back to people who are shilling, you know, the most influential gun writers were all revolver guys. Keith, Askins, later, a little later, Skelton, but even Julian Hatcher was a revolver guy. They thought the 1911 was a good wartime automatic, but and good for certain things. But, you know, they were revolver men. They were all those guys were revolver guys who grew up, and they influenced a lot of the market. I mean, a lot of people bought revolvers because those guys were at the forefront, and they basically sold a lot of them. And at the time, police, up until the, you know, early 80s, revolvers were the mainstay of the police. So, you know, in Europe, you can find that a lot of police departments, starting from almost the turn of the 20th century, were using small 32 caliber guns. I've got a small Webley that was the type used by the London Metropolitan Police. A little tiny thing, you know, doesn't inspire a lot of confidence, believe me. The German police up through the Munich 72 games and probably beyond that were using 32 caliber Walther PPs, you know. Then they kind of moved over to the P1 right after that. But you see a lot of the ex-police Walther PP32s were on the market for years. And you can still find them on the secondary market pretty easily. So they went to the smaller caliber semi-automatic as opposed to the larger caliber, meaning 38 Special and above, revolver cartridge. And that's just the way that evolved. And in fact, I think now it's been a real advantage, because in this country you can still get really fine revolvers, Ruger, Smith & Wesson, and apparently now Colt, making them better than they were before. You can get all those, you can still get a lot of those great revolvers. There's still a lot on the secondary market. But we also have, you know, the choice of the semi-automatic pistols, whatever you really want. So that's why they are popular here. And a lot of that, the last little tangent you can throw at that is, you know, there is that whole thing of the Old West. And in the Old West, up certainly until World War I, the revolver was widely used, and that is kind of the gun of record, the gun that won the West was a revolver. Not really, but that's what it was. Okay. Is NRL 22 a good sport for preteen and young teenage shooters? Ooh, that is an interesting question, because I have very limited experience with NRL 22. And I have to say that, first of all, I have to say, if dad's doing it and the teenagers want to do it and everybody's in agreement, I think it's a great thing. I think, yeah, go for it. Anything that keeps families shooting together is awesome. And so that's it. If you're out shopping for a sport, which is different, you know, dad's not doing it, mom's not doing it, you're saying, hey, of all these different sports out here, this NRL 22 looks kind of interesting. Would it be my first choice? My answer would be no. I think for younger shooters, they profit the most from a traditional, you know, kind of three position, standing, kneeling, and prone type program. That's really where they get some of their best experience and some of their best training. NRL 22 uses a lot of unorthodox shooting positions, which, unless you are kind of grounded in standard shooting positions, are going to be very, very difficult. The other problem is a lot of the standard three position programs, whether it's 4-H or junior ROTC or any of these other things, any kind of the NRA programs, they will supply equipment, and they kind of know that young shooters grow, so they have, kind of some modest guns that the youngest shooters go on, because they know the next year when they come back for the next season of this, they're going to be taller and their arms are longer and things. Then they'll have another rifle that will fit them more appropriately. If you're a parent and you're doing that, guess what? You are kind of buying a new gun every year, or you're trying to figure out something, or you're going with last year's and it doesn't fit as well anymore. So it's very, very nice that if you can be in a program where they provide the rifles so that you're not buying a whole lot of equipment that's not going to get used very often. It's not going to be used more than one season. So that's the good news with that. NRL 22 is a very can be very expensive to be competitive even in the junior divisions. I imagine that costs quite a bit of money. I know in the senior the regular divisions it's gone out of control. It's an arms race. And I would also say that the type of shooting, the time limits, the unorthodox positions, the cost of equipment, the cost of ammunition, like any other precision sport, it's got three aspects. You've got to have a good rifle, really good glass, and really good ammunition. And all three of those things are expensive, and they're also can be challenging to integrate. What I mean by that is, you want to find which ammunition shoots the best in your rifle, then you want to buy a large stock of it. You want to find the right glass and the right rifle, and it all kind of has to work together. So that's hard enough for an adult. I can tell you what I used, and this is by no means a recommendation because this is the lowest of low ends. But if your son or daughter really wants to be in that, and you're looking for something to hook them up with, what I used was a Savage Mark II 22. I used a primary arms scope, a 4x14 primary arms scope, and I put it in a Boyd's AT1 stock, which is an adjustable stock. Really nice. Works out pretty well. And then I put a, I can't even find it anymore, but I got like a $60 bipod off of Amazon. And frankly, it's a better bipod than the Harris bipod I bought for twice as much money a couple years ago. But that's what I bought. And for a sling, because you don't really use a sling very much in there, I used an old USGI M1 sling, not the 1907 leather sling, but the M1 canvas sling. And that's, you're just going to use that to kind of brace the rifle with, maybe take up a hasty sling or something, So that's what I used, and I shot with it. But there are guys who are dumping, ungodly amounts of money into this. And I don't know if that's the exposure, initial exposure to the shooting sports you want to give your teenager, which is, well, unless you got a lot of money, you're not really going to be competitive at this, because everybody wants to be competitive. And even in the junior divisions, they're going to look at their scores and look at some of the scores that these other guys are doing. Plus, the fact is that in NRL 22, reading the wind can be critical. And I would say that that's kind of an advanced skill, and I would not really want to put that on a kid. So my deal would be that unless mom and dad are already doing it, I would go for a traditional program and go there. And then when you have kind of mastered that, been in it for a couple of years, and then you can branch out, because a lot of the stuff will be second nature. I just think the learning curve in NRL 22 would just be too great for, a preteen or an early teen. Okay, next question. What are your tips for cold weather shooting? Okay, well, I live in the Midwest, and although we're having a mild winter this year, we have had bitter winters, is usually the norm. So, my deal is that there's no magic here. I dress appropriately, including boots and including gloves. And I will tell you that the thing that's going to give out the first are your hands. So, wear gloves. And what I do is I wear kind of Nomex aviator gloves, and then I put them inside of some GI mittens with the liners. And they can be shooting mittens, that ones that have the trigger finger. A lot of times I don't put my trigger finger in that little thing because it'll get cold, even in the mitten and everything. I kind of put it where the other fingers are to warm it up. But I like mittens. And wearing those when you're not actually shooting, as opposed to gloves, will keep your hands a lot warmer. The next thing is, depending on the type of weapons you're shooting, load your magazines at home. And if you're shooting ARs, and you probably have a lot of magazines, load all of your magazines at home in the warmth, because loading magazines in very cold conditions can be miserable because your hands, you can't really do it with gloves on very well. So your temptation will be you'll take your hands out, your hands will get cold. And I said the hands are the first thing to go and the hardest thing to warm back up. So that's what I would say there. I would also say bring some warm beverages with you, non-alcoholic, but bring warm beverages. And wear good boots because outside of your hands, the next things that are going to pay for you being out in the cold are your feet. So, sneakers and some of these goofy tactical boots, which are just kind of sneaker things, they're not going to cut it. They're great for running around and doing a lot of active stuff with. They're excellent for that. But you need some old school insulated boots and good insulated socks, not the gym socks that are made out of cotton. You need the good, acrylic wool blend socks. Another thing I'd like to keep are those little hand warmer gizmos. You can find them in hardware stores and all that. You can drop those in your pocket, and if your hands do get cold, why, you can drop those inside your mitten and hold them in your hands or hold them near you. Put them in your pocket, warm up your pocket, and put your hands in there. One of the things that I find is that everybody likes to buy a big parka because parkas they're cozy, man. They're warm. They're snuggly. They're warm and they're great. If you're going to do shooting, though, it's better to have layers. It's better to have layers than it is to rely on a big parka. And the reason is because it's just hard to shoot in a parka. It's going to throw the length of pull off. They're bulky. A lot of them are bulky. And while they'll keep you warm, they can be a real pain. So if you've got kind of these North Face, you wear the nice thermal underwear, then you can wear a good like a good wool shirt or felt shirt, felt shirt. Those, and then you wear kind of the North Face things on top of that. Hey, depending on the temperature, of course, you're going to be doing a lot better. And the nice part about layers are, there have been times when I've dressed like I'm going to Nome, Alaska, and somehow the day turns out warmer than you think. So you can always shuck layers. Whereas if you have a parka, hey, that's all or nothing. So if it's too warm for the parka, you take it off, you're going to find it maybe too cold to be without the parka. So it's nice to have intermediate layers where you can kind of maybe shuck the outer layer and you're still good with the inner stuff. And Gore-Tex makes a great outer layer if you're in the colder you get, the more layers you can add. So that's what I would say for cold weather shooting as far as dressing goes. Load your magazines at home. The other thing I say is if you like to use gun grease, go light on the gun grease. And I like CLP. That's a good lubricant to use. That's a liquid lubricant. But I like to use gun grease. I've, you know, when two when two surfaces are sliding against each other, it's really grease that really helps that. But you got to go light, and I use Mobile One synthetic grease, and that's a very, very good grease to use on a firearm, and it doesn't gunk up. You can put it on thin and it still lubricates and everything well, but it doesn't get all gunky and nasty. And as near as I can tell, it is pretty, it still does what it does even in extreme cold, because it does not, it's not petroleum based, so it really doesn't get hard or get sticky. It just seems to keep lubricating. But everybody's got their own thing for lubrication. But I say go, the best thing for cold weather is whatever you use, you want to go as light as possible with it. And you should be okay. Should be okay. Okay, why do you think the Ruger 5.7 will become a collector's item? Well, I covered this the last podcast, and I'll just give it a quick once over now. The Ruger 5.7 looks very, very cool. I mean, I like it. I mean, I don't have a need for it, but I'd like to have it just because it looks cool. It has that same kind of attraction the Desert Eagle has. It's like, hey, this is a little unusual, and it looks like it's going to be a very neat gun. So you look at it and you say, man, I'd kind of like to have that. That's something a little out of the norm that I'd like to have. The problem I see with it is ammunition is so freaking expensive that it's like the Desert Eagle in that way. With the Desert Eagle, you shoot factory whatever loads you shoot, or you do hand loads that are actually very, very powerful and can only use certain components because of the way it is and the way the gas system is. This is going to be the same way. I don't know that people are going to really be hand loading this mini rifle cartridge for the Ruger 5.7. It's not the 9mm that you take and say, yeah, here's four boxes of ammo and I'm just going to go burn these this afternoon practicing my drawing, my this, my that. It's not that gun. It's not the 1911 that, yeah, I just cast a whole bunch of 200 grain wad cutters and semi wad cutters, and I'm going to go ahead and load those up, and then I'm going to go shoot target. You know, I'll have enough for target shooting for the next 3 months. It's not that gun. So you have a gun that already out of the start gate, you're not going to shoot very much. And if you do shoot it, what do you shoot it at? Because it can damage targets, from what I understand, steel targets. So you're not going to be shooting a lot of gongs or steel with it. You know, I don't know what you're going to do with it. I suppose you can hunt with it. Although I don't know, since we've never had one evaluated yet, don't know if it possesses that kind of accuracy. Kind of would hope it would. It also has a 20-shot magazine. I'm not sure what that's about. You know, but it's a very cool gun. But I don't think they're going to make it that much longer. I mean, I think they're going to make it for like 2 years and realize that the sales aren't there. Then it quietly goes away. Then it becomes this cult collector's item. And there's precedent for that. Let's see, the Ruger Flat Top 44, the original one. The Ruger Hawkeye. The Ruger 44 Magnum Carbine, the original one. The Ruger PC9, the original one. A lot of Ruger guns come out, they don't sell very well, and then they just kind of go away. And then they become these kind of esoteric, cool collector's items that people want. So I think that it could very easily turn into one of those. Yeah, ammo too expensive, all the rest of it. And plus, it's chambered for one of these cartridges that's neither fish nor fowl. And we kind of have had these things all along. I think 351 Winchester, although it was never in a handgun, it's really kind of somewhat weak for a rifle round when you compare it to like 30-30 and things. Not that it's unuseful, but it's kind of underpowered for a rifle, but too powerful for a pistol. You know, 30 carbine is the same way, kind of, although a couple of handguns have been made for it years after it was introduced, it's kind of, nobody says that the 30 carbine is a real powerhouse. So it's not a very powerful rifle, and then it's kind of this awkwardly powerful handgun that, you know, it's not really a great handgun cartridge. It really, just really isn't. I think 10 millimeter is in danger. It's right on the brink of that. You know, it's like any handgun you have in 10 millimeter is very powerful, but by the same token, any carbine you have in it is not a 5.56. So it's kind of in between the two. Although I think there's some 10 millimeter revolvers out there that are very cool. Smith & Wesson makes one, and I think now Ruger makes one too. But it's a Magnum handgun round, and it, you know, it kind of falls in there. So there's a, and I'm sure there are other examples I can think of, you know, whether it's, you go back to 3220 or you know, some of these other things. So I think, but it's one of those ones, it's not really comfortable in a handgun, because the handgun's going to be bigger, and it's going to, you know, be kind of strange. And then you also, but you put it in a carbine, and it's not 5.56. So 5.56 outperforms it every which way you look at it. So, yeah, I don't think that'll be around too much longer. But get it while you can, and it would be an interesting gun, just like Desert Eagles are very interesting guns. This could be a very interesting gun also. Okay, next question. Why do you avoid rifles, AR rifles, in calibers other than 5.56? Okay, that's really easy. Everybody's different, and everybody has different needs. I find in an AR-type rifle, to me, 5.56 just can't be beat. Just can't beat it. I mean, it just can't beat it. It's got power, accuracy, range, all those things going for it. And it is economically, the ammunition is economically priced. Parts are everywhere. A lot of the scopes and optics are designed with 5.56 in mind. So, you know, it's really very economical. All the magazines are pretty trouble-free. You know, you're not looking for some weird magazine that takes a very, very unusual cartridge. So, but I realize there are hunters out there that need something else and all that. Why do I not like 308 or 7.62x51 ARs? And the answer is, it's not that I don't like them. It's just that I think, number one, they're a lot more expensive to shoot. They have a lot more recoil and essentially the same performance envelope. So you have that. And I just think that there's a magic with that 5.56. They hit everything just right. The size of the, and I'm talking a lot of this is referencing, it goes to all ARs, but I'm really kind of, the ones that are popping to the front of my mind are the retro ARs. But it goes well for the M4s also. So they, and the A2s and the other things. You know, I don't really care for an AR in a pistol caliber. I just don't see the need for it. I mean, I'm not a pistol carbine guy. The only pistol carbines I like are the ones that are just the semi-automatic legal representations of something fully automatic that everybody thinks is cool. So, like the Thompson, I think those are very cool. They are pistol caliber carbines, but they really are representing something else. You don't buy it because you want a 45 ACP carbine. You buy it because you want something that looks like a Thompson. So that's why I avoid them. I just I don't really care for them. I don't find them that interesting. Proprietary hunting cartridges designed for certain things are fine. You know, if you live in a part of the country where 350 Legend is exactly what you need, hey, go for it. If you live in a place or you are in a situation where 300 Blackout is what is for you, then I say go for it. I think it's great. You know, deal with it. If you really want something that looks like the original Stoner AR-10 and, you know, you get one of those Brownells guns, hey, great. You know, I did the same thing for 5.56. So, but I really don't have any use for any of the, I don't want to call them boutique calibers, but the kind of the add-on or proprietary or different calibers. I just don't need them. So I just don't really, I'm not attracted to them at all. Okay, what kind of music would you use for your podcast if you didn't have to pay for it? Well, as you know, my introductory song is public domain. So there you go. It's public domain, and you do that because people do have intellectual property, and using somebody else's stuff is not the right thing to do. Let's see. I think I would go. For guitar riff, if it was just a guitar riff, I think Fire on High by ELO would be a great introductory. That'd be a great introductory riff and beginning. I think that'd be awesome. Blue Oyster Cult. Smoke on the what is it, Smoke on the Water? Yeah, Smoke on the Water. That's another great one. Let's see. Anything Glenn Miller would probably be awesome. And of those, I think In the Mood or St. Louis March would be the winners. American Patrol is pretty high speed too, so I'd like any of those. Of course, when you're in your real rock out mood, Rolling Stones' "Sympathy for the Devil" would be a great one. They're just any U2 that would also be awesome. I think that'd be pretty good. If you want to feel corny, I guess you could have Roy Acuff singing "Wabash Cannonball" or something. I don't know. So there's a lot of cool songs out there, and yeah, it would be a lot of fun to use something like that. But anyway, those are my thoughts. That would be the music I would use. And actually, I know as soon as I stop talking about this, like two or three awesome choices are just going to come into my mind. But hey, maybe for another time. Well, that brings us to an end of this edition, the 55th edition of Old School Guns. So I hope you enjoy the content. If you do, hit the follower button, hit the like button, go to Podbean. You're always welcome to leave a comment, something you agree with, something you disagree with, a question. Go ahead and just put it all there. That would be great. And also understand that we're living in interesting times. Make sure in these upcoming primaries and all the rest of it, you vote. And like I said, my political stance is punish every Democrat for the sins of Pelosi, Schiff, and the rest of these jackasses. Punish everyone. If they got a D by their name, punish them. Punish them. Use your vote. Vote them out. And, let them know why. And the guy says, "Wow, why did I lose?" Well, it's because you are a member of a party that is really, I don't want to say committing treason, but yeah, something like that. It's something like that. So anyway, that is what is happening, and this is Old School Guns out.